Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The next few decades will see a profound energy transformation throughout the world. By the end of the century, and perhaps sooner, we will shift from fossil fuel dependence to rely primarily on renewable sources like solar, wind, biomass, and geothermal power. Driven by the need to avert catastrophic climate change and by the depletion of easily accessible oil, coal, and natural gas, this transformation will entail a major shift in how we live. What might a 100% renewable future look like? What challenges will we face in this transition, and how can we make sure our new system is just and equitable? This morning, we discussed these questions with energy expert Richard Heinberg, co-author of Our Renewable Future. Richard, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's good to be speaking with you again, Barbara.
Well, the last few times we've spoken, it's been about basically the crash of our fossil fuel economy. I remember the first book I interviewed about was called The Party's Over. Then there was The End of Growth. Most recently, Snake Oil about fracking. So why have you taken on, instead of looking at the crash of the fossil fuel economy, looking at how we actually rebuild a renewable economy now?
Well, it sort of stands to reason we're going to have to replace fossil fuels with something, and clearly the greatest hopes lie with renewable energy sources like solar and wind. I mean, once the fossil fuels are gone, we will be back to some kind of renewable energy economy one way or another in any case. So let's be proactive about this. And of course, David Fridley and I aren't the first energy analysts to consider the prospects of fossil fuels. There are a lot of reports and analyses out there now suggesting, you know, how long it will take, what it will cost to get to an all renewable future. So we wanted to see in a little more depth what will be required, and also to look not just at how many solar panels and wind turbines will be needed, but also how daily life will change. I mean, how will the ways that we use energy have to adapt to these different energy sources?
But one of the things I found really interesting in your book, and perhaps most engaging, was in a lot of other books that I've read and people I've talked to about making this renewable energy transition, they basically talk about how we have the technology to do it. Mainly, the main issue is the political will, and if we just had the political will, we could do it. And on that's on one side. Then, of course, there's other people who, Dick Cheney was perhaps the most extreme on one side, which said it's every American's God-given right to drive an SUV. But there are people who talk about how we need to have fossil fuels to transition. We need to have the bridge fuels. That's why we need nuclear power, or we need natural gas, and that we can't do it alone. You don't go to either one of those, and I'm particularly happy that you're not just kind of Pollyanna-ishly describing how a totally renewable future is in the cards and totally possible. But I wonder how you came upon this approach and how you deal with those people who basically say that, we can have like an all-electric America. We just have to change everything to electricity and everything will be fine.
Right. We did look systematically at energy usage, and the very first piece of information that I think anyone who starts to wrap their head around this whole subject needs to grapple with is that only about 20% of the energy that we use is in the form of electricity. And of course, solar and wind and geothermal produce electricity. So if we're going to change all of our energy usage to renewables, that means that we're either going to have to change our energy usage entirely to electricity, or find some way to use electricity to produce liquid fuels or gaseous fuels that would substitute for oil or natural gas. And it turns out that, you know, there are a lot of roadblocks along that path. Yes, we can build lots of solar panels and wind turbines, given the political will and given enough investment capital. But there are some challenges in terms of electrifying our energy usage in fields like manufacturing, in buildings, in transportation, in agriculture. And we're going to have to chase down all of those details and deal with them. And that's really where the research and development is going to be needed. It's not so much in energy production. We already have good enough solar panels and wind turbines, and they're still improving, and that's great. You know, a little more research in that area would be terrific. But where we really need the effort is on the energy usage side, and very little attention is going to that currently.
Well, let's talk a bit about some of the challenges of solar and wind in particular in terms of intermittency. And this is where the arguments, I mean, I've been hearing these arguments for 15 years or 20 years at least, about how neither one of these sources of energy is reliable enough to be able to become baseline. And that's why we need to continue to burn natural gas and why we should continue to build these natural gas power generators.
Right. Well, intermittency is a real problem. Sun doesn't always shine, wind doesn't always blow, and yet we want to use energy when we want to use it. We don't want to wait until conditions are just right. Well, there are basically three ways of dealing with the intermittency of these energy sources. One is capacity redundancy, just to build a lot more generation capacity than we're likely to need when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing. Another is energy storage, and batteries are only one of the several options in that instance. And the third strategy is demand adaptation, so that we in fact do change when we use energy, so that it more so that it better aligns with when it's available. Now, all of these strategies have their costs, whether it's the direct investment cost in purchasing massive battery banks to store electricity, or whether it's building lots more capacity than we would otherwise need, or the cost in terms of expectations and how we do business in terms of demand adaptation. And those costs have to be factored into our estimates of the cost of the energy transition, and also into our expectations of what we really want the end state to be. This is really the big takeaway that we came to in our year-long deep dive into renewable energy, that the biggest challenge is the challenge of scale. If we expect at the end of the day to have as much energy as we have now or more to fuel still more economic growth, the challenges are going to be really enormous. But if we can engineer not just the energy system, but also re-engineer our lifestyles so that we use much less energy, and here I'm talking about maybe half or a quarter as much energy as we're currently using, then all the engineering problems and the investment requirements become much more manageable.
Well, do you think that it's actually possible for us to be able to move to a totally renewable energy economy strictly through conservation? I mean, that's sometimes an argument that we hear people make, that if we just consume less, everything would be a lot better.
Right. Well, I think that's in the cards one way or another. We've gotten used to a scale of energy usage and patterns of energy usage that are really only suited to the sources of energy that we've been using for the past few decades, namely, cheap, abundant fossil fuels. But we've come to realize that these fossil fuels have hidden price attached to them in forms of climate change and air and water pollution and so on. And those costs are mounting rapidly, and at the same time we're realizing that we've been using these fuels according to the low-hanging fruit principle. So yeah, sure, there's lots of oil and gas and coal left in the ground, but we've used all the cheap, easy, good stuff, and what's left is going to be nasty, difficult, and expensive. So we've got to transition to alternative sources of energy one way or another. But you know, we, of course, what everyone would like would be to, you know, maintain business as usual, basically just keep living exactly the way we are now, only with different energy sources. But, you know, energy transitions, if you look back in history, have been transformative events. We build our societies to suit the energy sources that are available to us, whether it's hunting and gathering or simple agriculture or fossil fuels. You know, we've built the highway systems, the power generation systems, and all the rest of what basically the infrastructure of modern daily life around the unique characteristics of these fuels that just can't be maintained. These are unsustainable sources of energy. So what we have to do is re-engineer our lives and our energy usage infrastructure to suit the new energy sources that will be available to us.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, who, along with David Fridley, recently wrote a book called Our Renewable Future. Last week, I talked with Tom Prue, who's the editor of a book you contributed to, The State of the World 2016, Can a City Be Livable? And Can a City Be Sustainable? And I found it interesting that everybody in that book was talking about how more and more people around the world are moving to cities, and cities are actually a more efficient, energy efficient and more viable way for people to live, particularly in a world with shrinking fossil fuel resources. Except for your article. And your article was, which I really appreciated again. So I wanted to step aside. Let's run to that article for a moment to kind of talk about this vision that you had of what, if we are really going to be living with only, with all of our energy sources coming from renewable sources, why does that make you think that we probably can't continue to have ever growing cities and more people in cities?
Right. Well, you know, urbanization was the big trend of the last few decades in terms of demographics. And that was driven largely by cheap transport fuels. We could extract resources from very far away, transform them wherever it was cheapest to do so, maybe where the labor was cheapest or whatever. And then ship finished goods to people in large urban centers. And you know, so far so good. But transportation, you know, is going to be one of the big challenges of the renewable energy transition, particularly when you think of something like aviation. You know, how are we going to put big passenger planes in the air without cheap kerosene for jet fuel? Well, various people have ideas in that regard, including some kind of sophisticated biofuel or maybe super-cooled hydrogen. But, you know, those are going to be very expensive substitutes for what we're using right now. And when we looked at the prospects for a post-petroleum aviation system, the prospects just do not look very good. So when you start looking at aviation, at trucking, at shipping, and how to transition those away from fossil fuels, these are some of the most challenging areas in the whole energy transition scenario. So if transportation, and not just of people, but also of all the stuff that people use, if transportation is becoming more challenging, is becoming less efficient, is more difficult to undertake in a post-fossil fuel world, that suggests that the basic mechanism that has driven urbanization over the last several decades may not be so robust as to be able to maintain the levels of urbanization that we currently have, much less drive urbanization to even higher levels. So in the article, I was arguing that, you know, from a practical standpoint, this just may not be a realistic prospect for the future. And I'm happy to see in the current Scientific American an article called The Myth of the Sustainable City, which raises a lot of the same questions. So it's not just me who's talking about this. More and more people are starting to question this basic assumption.
Well, when I was reading your article and also reading Our Renewable Future, I kept thinking about how, in a way, the vision that you have is a world that I've been wanting to go back to for a while, which is basically I'm not sure, I totally want to go back to it, but part of it, where in the mid-70s, early mid-70s, when I was living out in the country, not far from Portland, and working with a bunch of other people who were kind of back to the landers and trying to figure out, we were studying what was called then appropriate technology and finding renewable ways to fuel our lives, but also really cutting back way back on our consumerism. And I wasn't really cutting back that much because I didn't have a whole lot of money then, being a poor hippie. And so I lived pretty simply. And I, you know, look back from a period of 35, 40 years, and sometimes I'm aghast at how tied into the whole consumer culture that I am and all the technology that I think I can't live without. So there's almost a nostalgia about thinking about going back to when we didn't feel like we needed so much. And and there's a thought about, like, how, well, I guess part of it is looking at this, these models we already have for how we used to live. And you mentioned before we had fossil fuels, we lived off of renewable energy sources for many, many millennium. So besides it being nostalgic, do you see that there's actually some, maybe some models for ways that we could look to live much more sustainably, to live with much less consumerism, and to have a much smaller carbon and otherwise all footprint?
Yeah. Well, you used a great phrase, which is appropriate technology. And this is a, as you said, this is an idea that was very current during the 1970s. But it's an idea whose time, I think, is very much on its way, if it's not here already. 1970s were a time of energy crisis when a lot of smart people started thinking about how we should and could do things very differently, much more energy efficiently, maybe changing our habits and expectations to reduce our energy usage. And a lot of really good ideas were developed back then. And some ideas had to do, for example, with constructing buildings that would use much, much less energy, using things like tromb walls and glazing in such ways to, you know, capture sunlight within buildings so that you wouldn't have to use fuel to heat them. Well, you know, once the energy crises were over here in the U.S., we mostly forgot all of that stuff. But over in Germany, a lot of engineers were really excited by all of this, and they took these ideas and ran with them, and the result was what's called the passive house movement. And they've built over 20,000 structures in Germany according to passive house standards, which use maybe one-tenth or less the amount of energy that Americans use in their homes currently, homes and buildings, office buildings, and so on. So the principles are there. The examples are there. We really just need to put that at the forefront of our thinking, change our building codes so that rather than constructing, you know, McMansions that are maybe going to have a 50-year lifetime and use enormous amounts of fuel to heat them, instead of those, we build smaller structures that are going to last a lot longer and be a lot more comfortable and will use much less energy on an annual basis. We know how to do it. It's just a matter of waking up and doing it.
Well, one of the things that really strikes me in your book is how we're running out of time. And I've been hearing this a lot, and many people have been saying this for a number of years, especially those people who are calling out about the potential climate crisis and carbon dioxide emissions back in the 70s. So if we're running out of time, I guess I'm looking at the lost opportunities and wondering how different it would be if Jimmy Carter had been reelected in 1980 and Ronald Reagan hadn't taken those solar panels off the White House and we continued to keep our thermostats at 68 degrees and wear those sweaters, if we would be in a really different place today and we wouldn't be facing some of the conundrums that you bring up in your book.
Well, yes, that's certainly true. And, you know, you're right. The urgency could hardly be greater, not only from the standpoint of climate, but also from the standpoint of, you know, our current fossil fuel economy is most people don't realize this, but it's really becoming very, very dysfunctional. The whole oil industry is, I wrote an article in Pacific Standard a couple of weeks ago called "Is the Oil Industry Dying?" If you look at the amount of debt that's held by the oil industry right now and the and the very low-grade resources that they're being forced to produce now because all of the good stuff is gone. They need very high oil prices to make a profit, and in fact, oil prices are way too low for most of these companies to be profitable. Well, you know, from a climate standpoint, we'd like to see the oil industry go bankrupt. The sooner the better. But the reality is that we need a stable economy on which to base the investments and the manufacturing and transport and all that will be required in order to install the renewable energy economy to replace our existing fossil fuel economy. So, you know, we only really have a very short period of time where we will have the wherewithal to invest and build and install this post-fossil fuel renewable energy infrastructure. And if we don't, you know, really get started, well, as you say, 10 years ago, but at least right now, then the chance will be over. It's not like, you know, in 2050 we can wake up and decide that, oh, yeah, that's a good priority, let's do that now. By then, well, even probably by 5 or 10 years from now, it'll be much too late to get started.
Well, one of my concerns with a lot of these goals that are set for greenhouse gas emissions reductions, like the ones here in Portland that are so touted around the world, that there's a pretty modest goal by 2020, a much more extreme goal by 2040, and by 2050 we have to be there. And somehow, right. This is a logarithmic curve to it that doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. Yeah, we need to be thinking about the heavy lifting that has to start today rather than putting it off. There are some things that are going to be relatively easy, like air source heat pumps, for example. We could electrify building heating in this country by changing out our natural gas and fuel oil heaters for air source heat pumps. These are available now from a number of manufacturers. They're far more efficient than the electric baseboard heaters that most of us are familiar with. And by electrifying building heat, then we have solved part of the transitional, problem. We can supply that electricity with more and more solar and wind. But where do you see the effort to do this? Are there building codes? Is there advertising? Most people don't even know what air source heat pumps are. They've never even heard of them. So, you know, we're not even doing some of the very easy things right now that we could be doing to speed up this energy transition.
Well, there's a guy that I interviewed who wrote a book called All Electric America. I talked with him last year. And he was one of the people who was very kind of simplistic. All we have to do is do this, and it's just the political world that's in the way. And he talked about air source heating and cooling. But it seemed to me that it's kind of expensive, so that a lot, like somebody who maybe put a new furnace in their house 15 years ago is not going to really want to change their heating source until that furnace dies in another 10 years or so. And some people, can't even afford to fix their furnaces when they're dead. So how do we make it equitable so that there's ways that people who can't afford these rather large infrastructure improvements in their own property, how do we make it possible for them and not just penalize them?
Right. Well, we're obviously going to have some, we're going to have some kind of system of subsidies to help people who can't afford it to do these things. Realistically, the average home is going to have to spend, the average household, I should say, is going to have to spend many thousands of dollars to adapt to a renewable energy future. And here I'm not talking just about putting solar panels on the roof, but, insulation, air source heat pump, for heating hot water as well. What about transportation, an electric car? You start adding these things up, and pretty soon you end up with a pretty sizable bill. Now, families that are still, making $100,000 a year, you know, you can budget for these things and it's easily doable. But families that are making $20,000 a year, $30,000, this is really daunting stuff. So again, we're going to have some kind of system of subsidies to enable households to make these investments. At the end of the day, they're going to be using less energy, and therefore it's going to be costing them less. But in order to get there, they're going to have to make some upfront investments. And that's really true for society as a whole. We're all going to have to pitch into this. And, you know, Bill McKibben had an article a few days ago calling this a war. You know, we basically have to have almost a wartime, no, not almost, but really a wartime level of cooperation and effort if we're going to optimize this transition. The transition's going to happen one way or another, but if we don't pitch in, if we don't start now, then at the end of the day, you know, we're going to have a situation that none of us would want, an energy system that no sane person would design.
Well, I'm thinking how, you know, the big pushes that have really transform technology and transform the world. I mean, one of them we always think about is the Manhattan Project. And what was the result of that? An atomic bomb. And then there was the Apollo Project. We got to the moon. But what I don't understand is here we are talking about the survival of the planet, and we can't seem to, I mean, we're very good at blowing up the planet, but we don't seem to be able to garner our forces to do something to transform our relationship to the planet so we don't destroy it.
Yeah, and, you know, many people say, well, look, you don't expect the government to subsidize this industry, renewable energy industry. I mean, that's not fair. It's a waste of taxpayer money. It's so and so. Well, as you were saying, you know, all our big technological transformations from the beginning of American history have happened as a result of government investment, whether it was the railroads, the telegraph, all the way up to the internet. None of these things would have happened without government, not only investment in research, but also investment in the process of build out. And it's certainly going to be true with the renewable energy transition. David Fridley and I were simply unable to identify a pathway in which the market alone would drive the energy transition fast enough to avert the problems either of climate change or fossil fuel depletion.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, who is co-author along with David Fridley of a book called Our Renewable Future, and we're talking about how our renewable future is not only inevitable but necessary, and that'd be something that we'd be good to get ahead of the curve instead of it happening and stabbing us in the back. We have basically energy chaos. One of the things that you point out in the book, which is maybe the most daunting, is how much fossil fuel we need to achieve a renewable energy future. So let's talk a little bit about what it will take in terms of resources and fossil fuel resources to build all those solar panels and wind turbines and other infrastructure that it'll take to have a completely electric grid for everything and have everything be based on renewable resources.
Right. Well, you know, it would be nice if we could bootstrap the process. In other words, if we could build all of the renewable energy infrastructure that we'll need, not only for energy generation but also energy usage, if we could do that with renewable energy. But that's, unfortunately, it's very unrealistic. First of all, we don't have enough renewable energy currently to begin to do that. And then we don't use renewable energy in ways that are suitable for those kinds of manufacturing processes. A lot of the stuff that we're going to need is stuff like concrete for anchoring wind turbines. Well, it turns out that concrete is dependent on fossil fuels for its manufacture, and it's in fact a very carbon intensive material. We produce it at very high temperatures. The cement for concrete is produced at about 1500 degrees Celsius, And there are theoretical pathways, perhaps, for producing cement in other ways, renewably with, you know, by focusing sunlight to produce very high temperatures, or by using a fuel made using surplus electricity and so on. But nobody's doing that. There are no pilot projects. There's no R&D into renewable cement. That's just one example. But there are lots that we could talk about. So we're going to be using fossil fuels to build this renewable energy infrastructure. And if at the same time we're also using fossil fuels to maintain our current energy usage for, you know, hopping in an airplane to fly to Las Vegas for the weekend and all the other things we're using fossil fuels for, the result is going to be a big carbon pulse, larger than business-as-usual scenarios, in fact. So the only way this is going to work is if we reduce our use of fossil fuels for most of the things we're using them for right now and replace that energy usage with renewable energy as quickly as possible while we're building out that infrastructure. So what we have to do is kind of fossil fuel triage, you know, start using fossil fuels only for the very most important things, whether it's as feedstocks for pharmaceuticals or energy for building solar panels or whatever. And when you start looking at it that way, I think we have to start thinking of our remaining fossil fuels, the remaining declining budget of usable fossil fuels, as being actually very, very valuable. We can't just use them willy-nilly for anything. We're going to have to use them for the very most essential purposes. And for most purposes, fossil fuels are going to be just too valuable to use.
Well, it seems that what we need to do, according to your book, is we have to give up certain things, which is something that most politicians don't want to. They don't like that.
Right.
To mention that.
Yeah.
And it's more than just giving up our SUVs. So I wanted to talk in the rest of the show about what we need to be changing both as individuals and communities to be able to make it to the future and not to turn into a dysfunctional dystopia, which we seem to be heading towards if we don't watch ourselves. So
So
it seems like the first place that we need to give up, the easy one maybe, but not for everybody, would be to stop traveling by plane.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Not only is aviation very carbon intensive, but it's also, as we mentioned earlier, it's an industry that's going to be very, very difficult to transition. But, you know, we survived for millennia without airplanes, so, you know, there are certainly ways we can survive without them in the future. And, yes, of course, it'll probably be possible to maintain some vestige of an airline industry for, you know, really essential functions, but it's going to be, you know, much smaller, very different looking than what we have now. Another field where, you know, we can get started right now is in agriculture. Our current food system is extremely fossil fuel intensive. We use at least 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce each calorie of food. And that's not just in the fuel for tractors, it's also in food processing and packaging, in transportation of inputs to the farm and outputs from the farm ultimately to the consumer's plate. Well, we know how to localize food systems. We know how to grow food organically without pesticides and herbicides made from fossil fuels and so on. And there's already a significant trend in the direction of local food, organic food, and so on. But, you know, basically what we need to do is make that trend go much, much faster so that within a few years, virtually all agriculture is organic. Virtually all food systems have been localized as much as possible. Then, you know, our buildings, it's not just a matter of putting air source heat pumps on the side of every American home. We also have to start thinking differently about how we build structures. Cement and steel, or concrete and steel, are going to be very problematic materials to produce without fossil fuels. So we need to start using locally sourced natural building materials and building structures that are smaller and that last a lot longer than the kinds of structures that we're currently putting up. You know, you start thinking about all of these things, transportation, the food system, buildings, and how they're going to have to change. And pretty soon, a kind of vision of our post-fossil fuel future begins to emerge that looks a lot different from how we're living right now, and maybe does have more in common with the way at least some folks were living a few decades ago. You know, rail is going to be our most efficient way of getting around and also of transporting goods and raw materials over land. Sailing ships are going to make a lot more sense once we don't have the bunker oil for giant container ships going back and forth between the West Coast and China. Back to the future.
Well, actually, I have, you're talking about building smaller, and I'm thinking about some photographs I was looking at of what's being touted by some environmental groups in Seattle as smart growth in Seattle, that they are doing a lot of infill and building these tall buildings and putting more people in less space. And this is seen as efficient, and this is it's much more energy efficient, it's much more land use efficient, it's good for the reducing carbon emissions and things like that.
Right.
But I'm wondering, are these buildings that they're going up in Seattle, they're going up in Portland, they're going up a lot, particularly in West Coast cities, is this really the way we should be building in the future? Denser and higher buildings?
I don't think we'll be able to build that way in the future if we don't have access to cheap concrete and steel. It's just not going to make sense. I think we're going to have to go back to building, again, with more local natural materials and probably building to human scale, enclosing less space per person. You know, the average American home has gone from 1,000 square feet in 1950 to 2,400 square feet today, and that's because we've had access to incredibly cheap building materials. And of course, we've also gotten used to building structures that, you know, we only expect to last them to last for 50 years or so. But that's a very energy intensive way of maintaining building stock, and the expectations we have of the amount of enclosed space per person, either in a household or in daily life, and in terms of the kinds of buildings we inhabit, it's very unrealistic. So, the metrics may work out right now for high-rise structures in terms of energy usage per capita, but over the long run, I think that trend is not sustainable.
Well, we have an economy right now that's basically based on planned obsolescence and the need to always buy the latest, greatest thing. So, like, the iPhone 7 is going to come out in a couple of weeks, but there's already talk about the iPhone 8. If we were to start thinking about whether it's our iPhone or our house, buying something that we really want to have last a long time, this is an investment and I'm not going to replace it in a year, is that a threat to capitalism?
Well, yeah, to the extent that capitalism is married to the consumer economy, I think it's not going to be able to survive this energy transition. Consumerism, you know, was a response in many ways to cheap energy. It was a way of stimulating more consumption and therefore more production, so more people could be employed. People were coming off the farms into the cities looking for work because we had mechanized farm work, again, with cheap fossil fuels. But, you know, none of that is going to work in a future where materials are in shorter supply, where due to simple depletion of resources, we won't be able to run a consumer economy. And also the energy won't work for consumerism. So what we'll need instead is a conserver economy, where you mentioned the iPhone. Well, this is one of the most challenging areas we identified, consumer electronics. A typical smartphone has 500 to 1,000 components, each of which has to be produced with an array of chemicals. Most of those chemicals either are fossil fuels or are produced with high heat from fossil fuels. Substituting all of that stuff is going to be a nightmare. The only future we could imagine for a smartphone, let's say, would be one in which you get one on your 18th birthday, and for the rest of your life, basically, you're patching it, repairing it, using recycled components to replace the existing components in it, because the consumerist planned obsolescence of these things is something that simply won't be able to be sustained in a post-fossil fuel energy regime.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that world, actually. I'm very tired of upgrading. It's really great to talk with you, Richard. I would like to continue this conversation. I'm wondering if we can continue it sometime in the near future.
Sure, yeah, let's schedule it.
Okay, we will do that. So thanks for joining us, and I hope to talk to you soon.
We've been talking. Okay, it's been a great conversation. Thanks, Barbara.
Sure, thank you. We've been talking with Richard Heinberg, who's co-author of Our Renewable Future, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll be talking about the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington, with Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey, senior organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper. My engineer is Natasha Delapine. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Esperanza Spalding. Thanks for listening.